Does everyone remember our Hebrew word for the weekend? Wow, that's incredible. Good job. Ahava. Ahava, what does it mean? Love. Covenant love. That's right. Covenant love. What about dod? Jonathan. And what about Re'aya, Re'aya. What was that? That's right. Companionship. What was that?
Cuddling.
That's a good translation. Like that. Let's take a look. Romance. Clearly, when the world or when Christians or most people think of the Song of Solomon in our day, it's largely abused, and this is almost all they want to talk about is the sexual aspects of the song. I think you might be surprised at how over-sexualized many people approach the book, but at the same time, it most definitely is the most unashamed and the most delighted context in all of Scripture around this subject. So, romance, summer love. The key verse is 4:10. How much better is your love than wine? And there the word dod is used, the intimate love between a husband and a wife. Three times over in 2:7, 3:5, and 8:4, three times over, the beloved bride cries out with urgency to caution young women, and by extension in principle, young men, to caution young people not to expose themselves to sexual realities before those desires can be fulfilled. Three times over, I urge you, and by the way, the importance of where these line up are sort of marker points, milestones in the song. They make division points. They're usually, or they're always, all three of them, they have this climax where there's this climax of something going on, like the one we looked at last time, before they could consummate the marriage. There's a climax of incredible, overwhelming desire. She can't handle it, and so she says, I'm warning you. And then it happens again after they're married, and she's saying again, I'm warning you. And then at the end of the song, it stresses it one last time to present the principle that, and just think of it this way. This strong caution is a statement in different words as to sexuality belongs to covenant marriage only. I warn you, don't play with this. This is only for marriage. So let's take a look at a few verses. In 1:2, it says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Very romantic. This is the idea that it's more than just other body parts being stimulated. This is holistic on the person. It's the soul and the body all together, loving the person. Kiss me with the kisses of the mouth, for your love is better than wine, and your anointing oils are fragrant, and so forth. 1:9 says, you make me crazy. You drive me crazy. Remember that? You're like this female in the middle of these male stallions racing, and you drive me crazy. You're like that. You drive me crazy. That's a very romantic concept of passion. One beloved excites the other beloved intimately, romantically. 1:13, my beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. And what she's doing here, now remember the context. This is before marriage, and she's thinking of marriage, before marriage. And so what she's singing about here, what this is celebrating here, is while she wants him and while she waits for him, and we know that at this point she's in preparation mode because she has this sachet, and it's expensive, this myrrh, and it was given to her as his engaged, betrothed, beloved, awaiting their marriage night. And so she's sitting there, she's laying there at night, and she has this sachet on, which emits these beautiful this beautiful aroma, and she can't stop thinking of him. So she's laying there, and this thing's laying between her, and she's just thinking, oh, how I wish he were here, laying with me that close. That's what that's talking about. As I await to be with him, I want him close to me. I wish he were like this sachet right here. 2:4. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. And this idea of the banqueting house is literally, it's a very romantic thing. It's not sexual. The idea is that he is the one who invited her all the way out from the countryside of nowhere land as a poor girl and brought her to this beautiful palace awaiting their magnificent wedding, a royal wedding, brought her to this incredible banquet house. This banquet house is a term that was used for like the finest presentation of the wines and cheeses and foods that they had, and it was all in preparation of the wedding ceremony. So he's the one who has called me, and his banner over me is love. That word banner is a word, a military word, that likely would have been known by David, his father, and Solomon. These are military men, and they carry banners. But it's beautiful. Essentially what she's saying is, I was an outcast country girl, but the romance in our love story is that he came and got me as though he conquered me in battle, and his banner was love. And he brought me from the country right into his palace. That's beautiful. That's the way we should think about how we romance one another. In 2:3 and all the way to 6, I give you the larger context we talked about last time. How about 2:16? Key verse, my beloved is mine and I am his. That is covenant. He grazes among the lilies. Don't over-sexualize again. I can't stand how some people have perverted things here. All this is saying is that he finds his nourishment among the garden flowers, the beauty of and the fragrance and the life-giving picture of this beautiful garden. And it's he finds his satisfaction and his nourishment of love there. In covenant, my beloved is mine and I am his. We have a covenant and he finds his satisfaction there. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft rock mountains. And you say, what? You know what the turn means? Do you think the turn means turn and come to me? No. Here she's saying, turn and leave me. How is that romantic? Well, context. This is before their wedding. This is at the time when they are already engaged and they're approaching the wedding very closely. Intensity's climbing. They're seeing each other, and it's like the last time we saw, she's saying, this is overwhelming, I can't handle it, help me, sustain me. Well, here what's happening is the same kind of thing, but this time she said, we got to draw the line. You've got to leave. If you don't leave, we're going to sin. And so the idea here is, think of it now in context. It's beautiful. She says, my beloved is mine, I am his. This is a betrothal. They are already committed to marry. And they're anticipating the full covenant ratification. And she's saying, and he will find his satisfaction only in that covenant. And that's why she uses the language, until the day breathes and the shadows flee. Right now we're in the shadows. And the wind of love has not opened to us yet. We are not ready. We have covenant, that's where we'll be satisfied, but we can't do this yet. So right now, the wind hasn't come, and you'll hear it in a moment when it does come. Wind hasn't come, we're in the shadows, the shadows haven't gone yet, and so therefore, my beloved, turn right now and leave. We can't do this. And be like a gazelle, just like you came, strong and mighty, desirous to come. Get out of here quick. And that's romantic because what? Why? Because it's expressing an authentic, genuine human experience of passionate desire. And yet, it's being governed by a moral compass. This is God's way, and we want the joy. We want to be satisfied. I want you to graze among the gift of the garden. I want you to have this in the covenant of our love. I am yours, you are mine. I want that. But until it's here, until the shadow's gone and we are open to it, we can't do this, turn and go. That's romantic. To say, this is passion, I want you so bad. But it's not all morals out the window. It's guided and governed by something even greater than our passion, and that is God. Well, then we see in 4:1. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Now, this is him talking to her on their wedding, at their wedding. So now she's got a veil, typical ancient Near East custom. And he is saying, oh, you are on their wedding before consummation. The romance here is he is so enthralled with her and so complimentary. He's explaining, expressing so much to her how he finds her attractive. And then 4:8, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Sinar and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. In other words, come from that out, that way out there place and come be with me. In other words, leave your family and join with me. Leave all that you know and all that you have and all that you were in your environment. Come, be my bride. You know, it's the first time he calls her a bride, 4:8. It's their wedding. And what he's essentially saying is in this covenant, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one. He's essentially affirming through poetic romance, we are separating from that which we were once before. We are now becoming one together. In 9 to 11, he says, you captivate my heart. You captivate my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. He is describing her holistically, the sights of her beauty, the smells, the sounds, just even her voice, he'll say elsewhere. But all of these things, he's expressing passionate desire for her. This is biblical wisdom. Now, I'm going to share with you. I ask you to, why don't you look in your Bibles if you don't mind. Turn to chapter 4. And this is why I said it's going to be a little, perhaps, it might be surprising to you. Because unlike those who are overly sexualizing every little metaphor and trying to find some sexual innuendo in every little statement made, which I find to be completely unmerited, what you're going to see right now is, now watch this, this is the most sexually explicit part of the entire book, right here. It's in verse 16. What you'll see, verse 16 starts. Remember earlier we said, not until the wind blows, she said, you have to go, we can't do this. Well, look at now. It's their wedding night. This is consummation. The ceremony is over. They're on their honeymoon. This is their night. And this is what is said. Awake, O north wind. It's opened. Now the wind can come. And come and come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden and let its spices flow. What that is saying is let the wind... It's like it's a picture again of the garden and the gift of life to Adam. God breathed. It's the same word, ruach. The ruach that gave life to nefesh in the soul of a man. So this same ruach of God breathes upon a covenant couple so that they are given a new life of a garden experience, a new life of life-giving paradise in their intimacy. That's the picture. The north and the south wind coming together is like male and female coming together in this rapturous experience. So come and blow, and the spices and the mountains of spice are descriptions of, again, spices have been used for all time, not only to enhance food, but also to present smell and aroma. And so it all comes together in this idea that this is the cream. This is the spice on top of all companionship and love. It's the thing that gives the pizzazz of the great experience of intense feeling. So come and blow and have this rapturous joining together. And then it says, and here's the most sexually explicit part, these next lines. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. And then he says, I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. That's it. That was their first sexual encounter. And then the response, the rhetorical device is, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with wine, intoxicated. This is like the marriage party saying, they're off. They're going off on their honeymoon. Be drunk with love. Be drunk with love. So there it is. They've consummated the marriage, and the way it's described is his and her about a garden. It's all about a garden. And the garden is not body parts. The garden is the picture of life, fullness, vibrancy, beauty. It's all that part of their experience together. Where's my, there we are. I had a couple of notes. I jotted down. I wanted you to think about this. Think of that physical intimacy in a marriage. Again, stress, stress, stress is not the root. It's the fruit. It's the fruit of a healthy marriage. A healthy marriage is the root. Companionship is the root. Humility is the soil where that root is. Love is the nourishment for that root. The fruit is intimacy. So, with that in mind, I want you to think in terms of this. The intimacy they experience and what's portrayed here in 4:16 and 5:1, this intimacy is portraying a harmony in a garden expressed in sexual terms. This garden is an echo of Eden. I want you to think about a garden. A garden is beautiful. It is pleasant. It is full of life. It is orderly. It is wild and yet cultivated. It is fruitful. It is aromatic. It is private. It is a place for retreat and relaxation. It is a place for meditation. It is an echo and a hint of life without the curse, and it is therefore equated always with paradise. And that's the picture. The picture is to be this treatment of it, this cultivating of it, understanding there's elements of it that are still wild, just natural, raw passion. But there's this sense in which there's a care and a beauty that is to be guarded and treated with reverence and respect. This crudeness of our day is totally foreign to God's delight and design. Again, it repulses me when I think about how sexuality is treated in our day, because it just rips out the soul of the person and creates this gross skeleton of just a body. And it's just for self-gratification. It's never love. That's how it's treated on the media. That's how it's treated everywhere. But let's finish this out, and I have one other little thought before we fill out some things. In 6:2, my beloved has gone down to his garden. Remember this, she wakes up and she realizes he's there the whole time. He's been in the midst of our love, in the cultivation of our marriage and its intimacy. Even though I was distraught, he is there to graze in the gardens and to gather the lilies. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies. In 6:5, turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. This is the husband. This is the husband saying, you're so beautiful, you overwhelm me. You can't, just don't even look at me right now. I'm like going crazy. that's amazing. And this is after their wedding. This is a married couple treating each other like that. You drive me crazy. Oh man, don't look at me. that's pretty cool. 7:10, I'm my beloved's and his desire is for me. One of my prayers is that would be something that each of the brides in this room could say, that I'm my beloved's and his desire is for me, that she would know that her husband has not just a sexual but a full romantic desire for his wife. 7:11 says, "Come, my beloved, let us go into the fields." She's again calling him out. "I want to get away with you." And we looked at that one already. And then 8:14, "Make haste." And this is how the song closes, "My beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag." And this has an overture to a sexual desire. She's calling him, "Be like you were before, passionate, strong, young, coming in. You want my love. I want you. Come, make haste. I desire you." What I was going to say next then is, before we do our song and fill it out, I just want to encourage you to remember this, that in the Scripture, the most beautiful expression that is very common, it's one of the most common ways to describe marital intimacy, physical sexual intimacy, is the word "no." Adam knew his wife, and she conceived. Over and over, you find throughout the story of the Old Testament, "and he knew her, and they conceived." In the New Testament, we find that Gabriel comes to Mary and says, "You're going to bear a child." And she says, "How can this be? For I have never known a man." So clearly, she knows men. But the word she's using is to describe really the way we should think about sexual intimacy. We should think about it in this way. Knowing the person. We should think about it as knowing, because knowing is beautiful. It is personal. It has more to do with the soul than the body. It is about companionship, and ultimately it is love. You cannot love what you do not know. And that's why pornography is so wicked. It's not a love at all. It is entirely devoid of love. It is a perversion of what should be love. You don't know the people you look at. That's why it's wrong. This is for people to know each other in a dimension and a level that no one else does. Knowing is a beautiful way to think of intimacy. Knowing them. Personal, soul, companionship, love. Sexual pleasure is designed for intimacy, but intimacy is designed for more than sexual pleasure. Very important. So let's take a few moments, fill this out. Let's read it first, page 109. The song is a celebration of love, beauty, and intimacy, romance. It is filled with joyous yearnings and pursuing tones. Desire for one another and playful interaction mark this couple's relationship. The pet names, repeated affirmations of love, compliments, and requests to come away and be with all of this spell romance. True intimacy has more to do with companionship than sexuality. How about your marriage? How important to you is romance? Write down your answer and then share it with your beloved. Discuss the level of desire you have for intimacy, not merely sexual, with your beloved. My request for this setting is that you simply write down how important romance is and be prepared to talk to your beloved in private. No. No. And then also, so two things. Fill out that one. How important is romance? Be prepared. Do it in a way that will help you to discuss this in private, maybe on the drive home if you're not carpooling. Why should sexual intimacy always be preceded, that should be preceded by soul intimacy? Go ahead and answer that one as well. Let's take a few moments. All right, let's calibrate our thinking. I want to challenge us to think everything should be tested in marriage if it's going to be truly Christ-centered. It must be tested against what? The gospel. So I ask the question, how then does the gospel apply to sexual intimacy? I want to offer to you two aspects. Number one, the gospel is absolutely essential to understanding, even practically, how we are to steward sexual intimacy in covenant marriage. And this is why. There's two parts of the gospel applied to sexual intimacy. Number one, the first aspect that I'm after is this. that the gospel teaches us that it is better to give than to receive. That the gospel teaches us love is a giving, not a lust which is getting. Remember the difference between love and lust. Love desires to give. Lust desires to get. The gospel teaches us that in our intimacy, our sexual intimacy, each beloved, each partner should seek to please the other first. It is a self-denial that expresses itself in love, not selfishly seeking to be satisfied by them, but rather seeking to satisfy them. So it flips it entirely on its head and changes the whole milieu of our culture on sexuality all being for me and my gratification, and turns it over really to a service of the most intimate and passionate type of love, that I would give my love to you. I really like how the song presents that, how she says, I will give you my love. She is saying, I'm calling you away, I want you, but how she expresses her sexual desire for him is, I want to give you my love. I think that's beautiful. That's one thing the gospel teaches us. That the act of love in the gospel is not something given in order to be received. It's something given to benefit the one that receives. And so it should be in our sexuality. You give sexually for the good and the benefit and the pleasure and the joy of the one you're loving. That's the first aspect of how you apply it. The second aspect of how you apply it is this. In the grand scheme of things, when we step back and really ask the bigger question, so what's this all about? Because there's not going to be this in heaven. For in heaven, there will be no marrying or given in marriage. For all will be like the angels who worship God. Ooh, maybe that's the answer. Maybe the intense pleasure we find through sexual intimacy in a marriage covenant of love is a symbol for a substance of eternal ecstasy in a covenant relationship of love to God. So that the symbol gives way to the substance, and I can tell you, truly, I believe this, that if sexual intimacy can give so much pleasure, it blows me away at the thought of what it'll be like to worship God naked and unashamed in his presence, with fullness of love brought there. Out from the wilderness, he brought me to his chambers because his banner over me is love. And there is a sense in which my worship of God will give me greater pleasure than any pleasure on earth can compare. And the highest example of that is in the protection of marriage known as sexual intimacy. And God says, yeah, that's just a shadow. That's just a drop in the bucket. That's just a taste, an echoing of Eden type taste of a symbol that will find a substance that will blow you away. We should have a hunger for God, a hunger for the real, the final, the ultimate, the total and final and complete satisfying joy of God. That's how the gospel applies. It helps us now to steward it well, to make much of Christ in it, so that you should be thanking each other in your intimacy. I thank God for you, my beloved. I thank God for our intimacy. I thank you for your love to me. And I should be eager to give my love, to please my beloved, before I seek to be satisfied myself. That's the first thing the gospel does. The second thing it does is it reminds me always, always and always, because even the greatest sexual pleasure on earth is still imperfect, and it still doesn't last, and we still need more. And that is to remind us, this is the symbol, and the full and the great and the final and the untainted exhilaration will be forever. At the right hand of God, there are pleasures forevermore. Oh, that's good, right? Are you with me? You understand this, right? It makes a passionate worshiper of God. So I get excited about it. So this is our problem. In sexuality, we often focus more on getting than giving. And we totally like step outside of Christianity when we get in the bedroom. Are you kidding? Our sexual life is coram Deo before the face of God. Don't step outside of the gospel as though this is too carnal for God. It's His design. With that in mind, I have a few principles. First of all, I love to start with this principle to remind everyone, oh, this is so important, to remind everyone that, first of all, where does pleasure come from? From God. He takes pleasure. Pleasure is His idea. Pleasure is His thing. It's not bad. Pleasure is God's. The Lord takes pleasure in those who fear Him and those who hope in His steadfast love. Those who look to Him and say, my beloved is mine and I am His. Those are the ones God takes pleasure in them. He is the one. Pleasure comes from Him. It's His idea. It's His design. It's His. Secondly, in terms of pleasure, He designed creation itself to please us. He says, look around in the garden, every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. He created things and He says, I made this for you. The very first time He described why He made something to Adam, the very first time He says, I made it to please you. And so it is with sexuality. He made it man and woman, one time for life, in a covenant protection of love and companionship to please you. You are to have pleasure in your marriage. It's God's. He created it for us to enjoy. And then lastly, you make known to me the path of life. In your presence, there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures evermore. This reminds us full circle. It first of all starts with God. He creates and gives it to us to enjoy so long as it honors Him. And it all points back to the substance. It comes back to with God in pleasure. That's the point. So pleasure is not the problem. Perversion is the problem. Purity is the way to guard pleasure rightly. Perversion is the problem, not pleasure. Make sense? God, that's good. All right, so here are our six biblical principles of marital intimacy. Number one, sexual intimacy in marriage is holy and pure. Holy and pure. God designed it. And in Hebrews 13:4, remember what He says? Keep the marriage bed undefiled. Keep it that way. He didn't say, don't have a marriage bed. He said, no, the marriage bed I made for you, for your pleasure, it's holy and it's pure. So don't let it become defiled. The question sometimes I've been asked, can a husband lust after his wife? Answer, absolutely. Wait a second, but they're married. Well, yeah, but here's the problem. When a husband lusts after his wife, what he's doing is he's desiring her to get instead of desiring her to give. Can a husband lust after his wife? Yes. Can a wife lust after her husband? Yes. Should they? No. It's holy and sacred. Keep it undefiled. Keep it pure. Make sure the pleasure is a gift of love. Now, number two, sexual intimacy is not the basis of marriage, and marriage is not primarily sexual. Oh, how the world needs to hear that. They think that, well, by having sex, they're married. Are you kidding? Jesus came across a woman who was having sex with a man and living with a man, and He said, go get your husband. She said, well, I don't have a husband. He goes, exactly. And the man that you're now with is not your husband, is he? Having sex together doesn't make you married. If it did, then again, logical fallacy, there would be no such thing as fornication. Because the instant you engage sexually, you're married. So there's no offense, no foul. No, marriage is a covenant. It's not built on sexuality. And by the way, if you could never have sex as a married couple, are you any less married? No. I love to tell the story. I won't go into it. But I get emotional usually when I tell it. B.B. Warfield, right? His wife, amazing story, could not enjoy the consummation of the marriage because of an accident. And for like the next 36 years, he loved that woman like no man I've seen. He loved her tenderly every day, walking out of his Princeton office to go and pick her up out of her bed and set her on the porch when the weather permitted to feed and sit with her and have lunch with her and read scripture to her and pray with her and just love her, caress her when she couldn't talk back, when she couldn't give him. He loved her. That's how we should love. That's marriage. It's not, sex doesn't make or break a marriage. It's the fruit, not the root. Love gives. It's seeking to satisfy your spouse first. Love gives. Love gives. Four, God created the marital union to be satisfying. He created it to be satisfying. We'll look at that in a moment. In 1 Corinthians, Paul addresses this directly. And he points out that God has designed marriage to satisfy your sexual desires. He gave you, he created us, wired us for these things. And he says that's only to be enjoyed in marriage. But it is to satisfy us. It is to be satisfied. And number five, sexual pleasure in marriage is not sinful and forbidden, but designed and encouraged. It's actually encouraged by God. I could take you to a number of places. I think specifically of Proverbs 15, 18. Remember what it says there? Be satisfied in the wife of your youth. And it's definitely sexual because next it says, and let her breasts fill you. So the point is, no matter what the age, you will always have a wife of youth, even if you married later in life. The idea is wherever you're at now, she was more youthful then. And the point is, when you married, right? When you married, you most likely, there was sexual intimacy and satisfaction. So wherever you're at after that, go back to that and be satisfied like that. And it's encouraged, be satisfied in the wife of your youth. So it is encouraged by God. And lastly, number six, sexual intimacy should be regular. And here are some just considerations. In fact, would you take your Bibles and open there, because we're going to look at this more carefully. In 1 Corinthians 7. And you'll see right from the text all of these details. So Paul is writing to the church in Corinth to address some questions they had. That's why he starts in verse 1. Now concerning the matters about what you wrote. Okay? So he's addressing sexual questions. And he makes it very clear that all are wired with some kind of sexual desire, and that brings about temptation, and that temptation can be very deadly. And he then points immediately to the idea of marriage and the importance of being satisfied in that marriage. Now notice what he says in verse 5. Do not deprive one another, except, here are the exceptions, except perhaps by agreement, that's the first one, mutual agreement, except by agreement, lost my place, for a limited time, and that's C, I have, for a limited agreed upon time, except by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. And that's prayer and fasting was typical among the Jews and among Christians long ago, that they would understand. And why is that? Why would prayer and fasting in any way suggest, well, maybe we should abstain from our sexual intimacy right now? Well, the reason for that is not because the sexual intimacy is bad or immoral or distracting from spiritual things, but rather the whole point of fasting is not to give up bad things, but to give up good things that you need to survive, like food and intimacy and marriage. It's good things that you need. But for the sake of a very real, concerted, deliberate effort to devote your focus on God in all things with the cravings that you have, hungering both for food and hungering for intimacy perhaps, that they would remind you and constantly be a witness to your soul, and thereby, in that deliberate action, you cast your soul on God and you entreat His grace. You are more intensely devoted to prayer when you fast. And that's why Paul says this, unless there's a need. And by the way, and as this chapter goes on, he talks about a unique need at the time in Corinth. They're going through a crisis And I think that's why he mentions that. That if you're going to pray over this crisis, then that would be one legitimate exception to not be regular in your intimacy. And by the way, there's a... I just want to make this clear because I care, and I think one of the responsibilities of a shepherd is to guard from things that aren't exactly right. So there's a book that I recommended last year. I still do. It's a great book. It's called Happily Ever After, put out by Desiring God. Very good. But the opening chapter, I just totally disagree with. It's written by Francis Chan. I don't like it. He totally takes it out of context and really, really casts it foreign to the context. He completely ignores and specifically misses two key exegetical points about the context of what Paul said. He said, in this crisis mode, it's better that you not marry. And so don't get married so you can be devoted to God. And Chan is like, well, that's how does that fit with Ephesians, you know, to love your wife and marriage is a picture of Christ. And he tries to be missional with it. And just, no, read the text for what it says. It's a crisis they're dealing with. And in that crisis, he says, in this crisis, like you guys are suffering persecution, you might die and people are starving to death. It might be better that you not get married if you're engaged right now, because that's going to bring a lot of hardship. That's the context. He's not giving a general statement to every Christian. By the way, it's not good for you to marry. You're more holy and more pious if you don't marry. That's ridiculous. It's not God's design. All right, that makes sense? Sorry. I got a little heated over that. But that's why he says prayer and fasting. Because that's the exception. In a crisis mode especially, or in any spiritually devoted time, you would do that. And lastly, D, resuming afterwards. And he says this explicitly. He says, again, verse 5, that you may devote yourself to prayer, but then come together again. And that's actually in the imperative. You do this. Come together again. Come together again. And he points again to one other reason, and that other reason is so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. He understands the power of sexual need, and he understands it creates an incredible vulnerability. And this is a very real problem in marriages today. When there's manipulation and sexual politics going on in the home, and leverage being and all that stuff going on, and when it's all about lust and not love, then temptations start to rise, and pretty soon you can't, I mean, you are so vulnerable. You're not excused. Never does one, your beloved not fulfilling you sexually, never does that give you license or excuse you in sin, ever. But it certainly will make you seriously vulnerable. And if each of you love one another, you understand that. And I can say, I think through experience and the stress in the text of Scripture, generally it's the man that has the greater vulnerability here. Usually the stronger drive, the stronger desire to be sexually fulfilled, and it comes more frequently and more intense, and it does need to be satisfied rightly, or it makes him incredibly vulnerable. And with this over-sexualized culture, it's very dangerous. So it's important. It makes sense? Now, with that in mind, I have on the next page, page 111, four principles of sexual satisfaction, since we just talked about that. Number one, exclusively. Exclusively with your beloved. Each of these are with your, or in, you know, beloved, in the context of your beloved. Exclusively with your beloved here. And this, again, is Proverbs 5:15 and 1 Corinthians 7, which we just looked at. And specifically in 1 Corinthians, he says this: the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. Notice how, again, it's stated in the context of love, not that the husband should get something from her and she should yield, but he starts with the husband and says, you should give to her. And I love that. It's a picture of the headship and the leadership of the man, that his first concern sexually is to satisfy his wife. And that she, he turns reciprocal and says, then she should give to him. And he takes what we always do. This is my right. This is my body. I have. And he says, no. Take your right and give it to him. Take your right and give it to her. Right? That's what he did. Give to her rights and give to him his rights. you don't claim rights on your own. That's pretty striking. A rebelliousness in us says, no, I don't like that. It should be exclusive, though, to husband and wife. That's the point he's making, to the husband, to the wife. It's exclusive, they're exclusive. And then also in Proverbs 5, the whole point of Proverbs 5, 15 to 17 is about the danger of seduction and being satisfied in the wife of your youth, in the covenant relationship. The second principle of satisfaction is going to be mutually, that it's mutually satisfying. So again, if it's not mutually, if it's not sought after, it doesn't mean it's always going to be mutual. It's not always going to be experienced the same or to the same degree of pleasure, but for each. But the reality is the aim should be. The aim should be selfless, both parties selfless. Three, delightful. This is where the terminology that's used here in the scriptures are pretty striking. Proverbs 5:9 says, "A lovely deer, a graceful doe, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love." That word intoxicated is used by Isaiah in 28, and he says, there's a man who staggers with strong drink. He's so intoxicated, he staggers. And the idea is that you would be so delighted, overwhelmed, like intoxicated with the satisfaction of your bride. That's what's being called for. And then the last one is regularly, which we touched on already. But in 5:19, I just wanted to bring this out one more time. Again, a lovely deer, a graceful doe, let her breast fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. So the key is, again, this exclusive, mutual, delightful, regular satisfaction of sexual intimacy. The Puritans give, I think, the best picture of sexuality in a marriage. And it's a fireplace. This is why. Because fire, if it's in its proper place, it warms the home. It provides warmth and it provides all the necessities for cooking our food and providing us again with the sustenance to survive the cold. But when a fire gets out of its right place, it doesn't help the home. It burns it down, destroys it. But when fire, sexual passion, when it's in its right place, it's good. It provides, it warms, it is so good. Out of place, it's more than deadly. It destroys everything without mercy. That's sexuality. Out of place, it will destroy a marriage without mercy. All right. Is this helpful? If anyone should be talking about human sexuality, I think it should be the church. And remember and notice how I went through all that and I talked about some pretty serious detail and I didn't have to resort to crude language. We shouldn't. The song teaches us that. It's beautiful poetry.